You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 2nd of September 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Marcus Hippie.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be setting the day's agenda with the three stories you'll need to know on this Monday. Joining us in the studio is Martin Plaut. Martin, what are we looking at today?
Well, one is the release of Nelson Mandela, why it was announced by international organizations a day before it actually took place. The second one is the 500,000 people that have been made homeless in Sudan by the flooding. And the third is why we should take notice of sodium fluoride and potassium fluoride today. They're very important.
Excellent stuff, Martin. Plus, as the crisis in Syria continues, one figure has emerged as cutting a very solitary shadow, Barack Obama. We'll discuss why the president seems to be going it alone.
And in a country that many in the international community don't even recognize, we find out why literature is thriving in Somaliland.
And we meet half of the rap duo Syllable in Brains, the subject of a new film called The Great Hip Hop Hoax.
So we used one talent to highlight another talent. That's marketing. That's not lying, really. Once we were in and everyone saw that the talent was real, it was just like, oh, wow.
All that plus we play some music too, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
So a busy 60 minutes coming up ahead, but before all that, here is Barney Burnham with the world headlines.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. US defense officials say the nuclear-powered aircraft carrier USS Nimitz and other ships in its strike group are heading west towards the Red Sea to help support a limited US strike on Syria if needed. The group, which includes four destroyers and a cruiser, has no specific orders to move to the eastern Mediterranean at this point, but is moving west in the Arabian Sea, so it can do so if asked. It's not immediately clear when the ships will enter the Red Sea. They hadn't arrived by Sunday evening. On Sunday, members of the US Congress met President Obama's national security team to discuss the possibility of military action. Lawmakers raised a broad array of concerns, including the potential effectiveness of limited strikes, the possible unintended consequence of sparking a wider Middle East conflict, the wisdom of acting without broader international backing to share the burden, and the war weariness of the American public. Following the meeting, opinions were still divided about possible intervention in Syria. Texas Republican Michael Burgess remains unconvinced.
There's a lot of information. There's a lot of pros and cons. I have to tell you, it's in my mind, it's far from settled. It's not something that should be undertaken lightly. Certainly the mood at the district that I represent is do not do this, and I honestly didn't hear anything that told me I ought to have a different position.
A number of Middle Eastern countries are advising against U.S. military action, but the opposition Syrian National Coalition is urging Congress to come down in favor of intervention. SNC spokesman Khaled Saleh.
We are urging the United States Congress to move swiftly and to give President Obama the vote that he asked for. North Korea and Iran are watching very closely what happens in the U.S. Congress. It will be a very dangerous message if Congress decides not to move with President Obama, not for the U.S. to act after Assad used chemical weapons. I think the whole world is watching. They carry a very heavy burden on their shoulder, and we're going to be waiting for their vote.
The Egyptian state prosecutor says the ousted President Mohamed Morsi is to be tried for inciting the murder of protesters. The charges relate to last December's violence outside the presidential palace in Cairo, in which at least seven demonstrators were killed. 14 members of Morsi's Muslim Brotherhood will also stand trial on the same charges. North and South Korean delegations will today come together for the first meeting of the newly formed Joint Committee on Kaesong Industrial Complex. Kaesong, situated in North Korea, was closed down in April amidst high tension on the Korean Peninsula, with the North threatening the United States and the South with missile attacks. On Thursday, Pyongyang and Seoul signed an agreement on forming a joint committee to run the complex. The date for its reopening is expected to be discussed at today's meeting. The wildfire, which has destroyed around 6% of Yosemite National Park, is now the fourth largest in California's history. By Sunday, the Rim Fire had charred nearly 223,000 acres, mostly in the Stanislaus National Forest that spreads out from Yosemite's western edge. Its footprint is now greater than the area of Dallas, but officials say fire crews managed to slow its progress over the weekend. The California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection says five of the state's seven largest fires in recorded history have occurred since 2007. A 24-year-old Welshman has become the most expensive footballer ever. Cardiff-born Gareth Bale has finally completed his long-awaited move from English club Tottenham Hotspur to the Spanish giants Real Madrid for a fee of €100 million. Tottenham manager Andres Villas-Boas has wished him good luck with the move.
The player is an absolute wonderful player. He's going to join the going to join Real Madrid. So we wish him all the best. He's left it with great memories from last season, which I think every Tottenham fan cherishes. But he has moved on, and we move on as well.
Those are the main stories here on Monaco 24.
Thank you, Barney. It is 17.06 in Sydney, 11.06 in Moscow, and 8.06 in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London. It's time now for us to set the day's agenda with some of the stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. Well, joining us this morning in the studio is Martin Plaut. He is former Africa editor for the BBC World Service and fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies here in London. Martin, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much.
Let's begin to these devastating floods that are continuing to ravage Sudan.
Yes, they absolutely are, and it's something that has received almost no coverage across the world. It's really sad. Something like 500,000 people, perhaps 530,000 people, are actually affected by them. You know, tens of thousands of homes have been inundated, walls destroyed, people washed away. Dozens of people have died. Mostly this has been around the area of Khartoum, where the Blue and the White Nile converge, but also in huge areas in Blue Nile and South Kordofan, which are areas that have been hit by rebellions in the past few years.
How much international help has Sudan received this far?
Well, almost nothing. I mean, there has been an appeal made by the United Nations, by OCHA, the Organization for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. There has been something coming in from Kuwait and from some of the other Gulf states. They have produced something, but it's really been on a tiny scale. And if you want to actually see how large it is, there are some amazing satellite images that have been produced by the United Nations showing just how large the areas of devastation are. But, you know, it just is seen as sort of, well, that's one of those things, happens most years. Tough. They must just live with it. And it's a tragedy, really.
And one of the areas in Sudan which is really being heavily affected is also the Pibor country. Something like 90,000 people are still missing from that part of Sudan. You mentioned the fighting there, the rebellion, the South Sudan fighting. Lots of men particularly are finding that they're unwilling to go to these medical centers that have been set up by AIDS organizations because they're afraid of kind of repercussions if they go visit these medical facilities. How much of is that having an impact on the aid effort?
Well, it certainly is. And, you know, one of the things that has happened is that the Sudan People's Liberation Army North, which is one of the rebel groups that's fighting, particularly in Blue Nile and South Kordofan, have said, look, let's have a month-long truce in order so that aid can get into the people who need it. But the government has turned it down, saying, well, this is just a trick. It's just a, you know, propaganda exercise, which is really sad because, you know, those people really do need the help.
And if we move on to your second story, there are quite a few furious politicians in the UK. It's turned out that Britain has allowed firms to sell chemicals to Syria capable of being used to make nerve gas as long as 10 months after the war began. What is the explanation for that?
Well, this happened on the 17th and 18th of January last year. A number of companies, we don't know how many, were allowed to sell something called potassium fluoride and sodium fluoride. Now, let me be honest, I know nothing about these things, but I'm told that they are elements which are integral to the construction of chemical weapons. Now, these chemicals were never actually supplied. They didn't leave the United Kingdom. But to allow this to take place, when they are on the potential list of elements that you can use to build chemical weapons, 10 months, as you say, after the war began, was an extraordinary decision by the government. Now, Vince Cable, who's the Secretary of State responsible for this, says, well, you know, that we had no particular reason at the time to know that this was going to be a problem. But it is an extraordinary decision.
It's absolutely startling. And he even admitted himself that it was only just as a matter of luck that these chemicals weren't sent to Syria.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, this goes against the Chemicals Weapons Convention, which I just happen to have here, which talks about, you know, it's that it is illegal to assist, encourage or induce in any way anyone to engage in any activity that is prohibited to state parties. So you can't do it. It then says you can't use any chemical which has a high potential for use in activities prohibited under the convention, and also that, you know, you cannot provide anything that could be a precursor to one of the chemical reactions at the final stage of formation of the chemicals. So it's not just that you supply a weapon, but anything that could produce a weapon is also clearly banned. Now, how this could have allowed this to happen, not spot it, and just say, well, this is to produce, aluminium window frames, which it may do, is just extraordinary in the kind of circumstances that we're in now, where there's a civil war.
What happens next?
Well, this is certainly going to be raised in the House of Commons. The Labour Party business secretary says he's going to do it. He says that he's very he's relieved that it didn't happen, but that he's going to ask questions about it. Look, it's not going to lead to World War III, but this could have been a really major ratcheting up of the whole situation.
How damaging is this for Prime Minister David Cameron and his coalition? Of course, last week he failed to get the vote he wanted in the House of Commons. It really just shows the disarray, perhaps, that's happening in his coalition. Is he beginning to lose control of what's happening?
I think it is sort of slipping. I wouldn't say that he's losing control. I think that that's too strong. But things are clearly slipping. But the other thing that I think is interesting this morning is that the Times is reporting that a number of senior people, both in the Liberal Democrats, in the Tories and in Labour, are beginning to say, well, hang on, were we really right in saying no to using weapons? So this may be back on the agenda again in a couple of weeks' time. One other thing we shouldn't forget is that it could take 2 weeks before the inspector's report is finally available. So there's this period of uncertainty where these kind of things are going to be bubbling up, both in Britain and in the United States.
And as we know, that report isn't going to say whether the rebels or government troops used the chemical weapons. Either.
Indeed, it's going to be difficult. It's going to be a strange one, isn't it?
Do you think this is going to damage UK's reputation?
I think so, yes. It's not the sort of thing that you want coming out. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, Britain is a major manufacturer of chemicals. I mean, it's one of the few things that Britain still does manufacture in large quantities. And so, in a sense, it almost would be surprising that they aren't producing something that in some way couldn't be used for chemical weapons.
And finally, Martin, let's move on to a good news story here. Nelson Mandela finally released back home to receive intensive care back at his home. But lots of controversy now about who knew what when.
Exactly. I mean, this was announced by the international media, by the BBC, by Sky and by CNN a day before it happened. And the question now is, why did that take place? And I think it's now become clear that what has happened is that there's competing briefing by people in the large extended Mandela household, particularly his family. They're all vying for position, frankly, ahead of his death. And, you know, him being taken home is not necessarily good news. It could be that he's been taken home to die. But anyway, these members of his family now sort of jockey with each other, and there's a lot of money involved in this, in briefing the media and trying to get ahead of anyone else. And that is why the international media were a day early in announcing it, and were wrong, of course, when saying that he had been released. It was a day early. And it's a terribly unsavory situation.
So, knowing that background, do you think the media should be aware of that background and kind of like change the attitude when it comes to reporting?
Well, the trouble is, would you like to be second in reporting the story? No. As a journalist? Exactly. Nor would I. And I think that is the reason they do it. But do you know how much has been spent by the BBC alone in preparing for this story, in flying people backwards and forwards, waiting for it?
What are the numbers?
£300,000. It's a lot of money in a travel budget, which is tight. And the BBC's travel budget is tight. People have been going backwards and forwards the whole time, just in case Mandela dies. Nobody wants to be in the situation where they can't cover it.
Thank you very much. That was Martin Plaut, former Africa editor for the BBC World Service.
And we will be getting more on the story of Nelson Mandela with our correspondent in Nairobi, Tristan McConnell, later on in the program. Though coming up, though, next, we'll be discussing the long and rather lonely road for President Barack Obama.
Each week, Section D takes a thorough look at the design world. From fashion to furniture, from lighting to tasteful living, we'll bring you the most interesting news from design studios across the globe.
Where is society going? What is the furniture that will lead what society will want in terms of furniture functions and forms?
We see that more and more contemporary designers actually do not think about the mass-produced object. That's not what drives them. That's not what they're interested in. That's not what they think they want to contribute to this world.
You can't really create 240 years of a story. What I'm saying is the brand has incredible authenticity and creates integrity.
It's not just making clothes, but shoes and accessories and thinking about the character or the narrative of the collection.
Join me, Tom Morris, on Section D, your one-stop guide to the world of design.
That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, in association with Lexus.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Marcus Hippie. The time is 10:17 in Damascus. It is 8:17 here in London. Now, as the uncertainty over international intervention in Syria continues, one world leader has emerged as cutting a very lonely figure.
A red line for us is we start seeing a whole bunch of chemical weapons moving around or being utilized. That would change my calculus. That would change my equation.
Barack Obama there from August 2012 stating that if a red line was crossed, the U.S. and others would act. But if the red line has indeed been crossed, Obama won't intervene until he gets approval from Congress.
Obama may have hoped for a decisive strike in Syria to send the regime and the world a message. But instead, many pundits are saying he has come across a leading from behind, and even worse, appearing weak. So has the rhetoric got ahead of the policymaking, and is the president double down on the issue of what happens next in Syria? Joining us today in the studio is Dr. James Boyce from King's College London to shed some light on the American perspective. Thank you very much for joining this program. So President Obama is indeed in a very tricky situation. How much can he do in order not to appear weak?
Well, to not appear weak, he will probably need to go back in time to a point before this weekend, quite frankly. I think that ever since he issued the red line statement that you just highlighted there, which was by all accounts going beyond his brief and beyond where he'd wanted to be at that point, he and his administration have been desperately trying to walk that back. So you've seen over the last 12 months, time and time again, whenever any new allegation has come out of Syria, there's been a sort of a hedging and a whoring out of the White House, much akin to when Clinton was president and there was a denial of genocide. So they called it acts of genocide to avoid having to act. And I think you've seen something similar come out of the Obama White House.
How surprising then was it that Obama went and announced in the Rose Garden there a couple days ago that he'll indeed be going to Capitol Hill to get approval from Congress? It is looking like it's going to be quite a tight and difficult challenge for him. But the question is, did he really have any other choice? There was a Republican representative in the House who petitioned others, and he gained over 100 signatures from both sides of the aisle saying that Obama should go to Congress before acting. Did he have really much of a choice?
Well, there's a number of points in your question there, but A, it was surprising. B, it was also very revealing because a number of us have been thinking, well, how's he going to get out of this? Because clearly he was expecting to get British support. Most people, I think, expected Cameron to be able to get his motion through the House, even if it was only narrowly. And that would have given the Americans some political cover. When that went away, with all respect to the French, you know, that's not an awful lot of a fig leaf upon a policy. So all of a sudden, the president was on the back foot, and it was interesting from a political science point of view to see how he managed to wriggle out of this, coming out into the Rose Garden saying, well, guess what, folks, I am Commander-in-Chief, I'll make the decision, but you know what, because I'm a political scientist and I used to be a professor, I'm going to kick this back into Congress. And what it's done is it's reversed decades worth of executive power, effectively, and most presidents want to grab as much power as possible. And Obama seems very, very happy at this point, for various reasons, to kick this back into Congress. And I think there's a hidden agenda here myself.
We just heard the famous red line comment from President Obama. As a consequence, is Obama administration now bound to a policy they would not otherwise necessarily pursue?
Well, here's the ridiculous thing about this, is that the Obama administration, in the form of the president, has said, I believe I can act as Commander-in-Chief, but I want to get as wide a consensus as possible. So I'm going to give this to Congress. I don't know whether he hopes Congress will approve this or prevent it. But either way, he's still reserving the right to act at whatever Congress says. So there's some really strange political dance going on at the moment. He's saying we want to kick this back to Congress. And yet at the same time, he and his Secretary of State are saying, I'm still reserve my right to act as Commander-in-Chief.
But why is that ridiculous to try to gain approval and a consensus among, as he put it in his very own words, representatives of the people?
Because I'm not entirely convinced that he wants this to go through. I think he's working for wriggle room to get out of this.
Most pundits do think that it will go through.
Well, not everybody. Let's be honest about this.
Well, Bill Kristol yesterday on Meet the Press, who's of course a leading conservative, said on the program that he believes that the Republicans will do the right thing and pass that bill.
It's entirely possible, but you might well get the Democrats, for example, who won't vote for his own party. Let's be honest. Here in London, for example, it was if all the Conservatives had voted with David Cameron, we'd be on side now. So I wonder whether there's some political hijinks going on here, that Barack Obama has finally found a very clever way out of this. He can maintain the moral high ground and say, you see, I wanted this to happen. I'm going to put it to Congress. And then if it doesn't go through, he can blame Congress if this doesn't pass.
So what do you expect to see happening in the US during the following days?
Well, let's not forget, in the coming days, what you're going to see is the White House lobbying Congress to try and get this through. But it's important to recognize that the Congress has pretty much already rejected its initial proposal anyway, and basically said, well, we're going to rewrite this, because by all accounts, what the White House had sent forward maintained an ability to put troops on the ground, which Congress is not going to approve at all. So you're going to see a lot of political hedging. Don't forget, Congress isn't even coming back into session until a week today. And that's when it can start to think about this. So, you know, we're not going to see much action, I don't think, for at least, 10 days at the very least, I would have thought.
And the administration did give that bill to Congress in the very broadest of terms, in the hopes that Congress would, of course, narrow it down as it expected. And, you know, he could potentially argue that, look, Congress is working, they were able to put together a nice bill. What's your prediction? They're going to be coming back from recess on September the 9th. Do you think it'll pass?
I think it's going to be very, very close. It certainly isn't going to pass in the form that the White House originally intended it to. And it's just a question of whether the Republicans and the Democrats can come to some sort of compromise bill that the White House is happy with. And at this point, it's far too early to judge.
And of course, this is all in the shadows of a looming government shutdown as well at the end of the month.
Absolutely.
So just one of many things for them to consider. James Boyes from King's College London, many thanks for joining us here on the program.
This is Midori House on Monocle 24. When you think of world-renowned international literature festivals, the Hargeisa Book Fair in Somaliland may not immediately pop to mind. But the self-declared autonomous region in the north of Somalia has had a successful book fair for 6 consecutive years. This is despite the international community not acknowledging its very existence.
But in the face of some pretty big hurdles, including news that Barclays will be pulling out of the region over fears of money laundering, the Hargeisa Book Fair has managed to become one of the continent's most important festivals. Well, earlier Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloomfield spoke to Michaela Wrong about the festival and the importance of the Hargeisa Book Fair.
Now, when we talk about Somalia, the thing that comes to mind isn't perhaps books, and yet the Somali language has an incredibly strong literary tradition. If you ask a Somali to name a national icon, they'll probably name a poet.
Yes, that's what really impressed me, because I didn't know anything about this culture. But the great star of this fair, which is now in its sixth year, was this elderly gentleman. He's in his 70s, called Hadrawi is his nickname, which apparently means big gob. And he just transfixed the audience. And obviously, you know, older Somalis knew all his stuff by heart. I mean, they were kind of almost saying the poetry along with him. But youngsters were listening in. And Somalia has this nomadic culture. I mean, people just wander across the desert with their camels and their goats. And so in that kind of culture, you're going to get poetry and songs and recitation as a very important part of handing on tradition and keeping yourselves amused. And so this poetry thing is incredibly important.
And I guess also one of the funny things about the language is that it wasn't until about 40 years ago that it was actually officially written down. It's always been a very oral language.
Yes, and it's a very curious, if you look at it written down.
Lots of A's, lots of X's.
And apparently it does help you, because it helps you guide in the pronunciation. I must admit, I didn't try.
Now, Hargeisa, the city itself, it's the capital of Somaliland, not Somalia.
Right.
Except Somaliland technically sort of doesn't really exist.
Yes, I mean, this is the thing. For 22 years, they've been trying to win recognition, international recognition, for their autonomy, for their national sovereignty. And their argument is, you know, we have a very different history. We are from the rest of Somalia. We are at peace. They had this very traumatic history when Siad Barre in 1988 bombed Hargeisa.
So this was the president of Somalia, was bombing essentially his own country.
I mean, this was the beginning of the end of the Siad Barre regime and the beginning of the start of the civil war that then tore the country apart. We won our independence. And since then, you know, they have been setting up the structures of the state. They've had a series of peaceful elections.
I mean, those elections are incredible. I mean, I remember going there before the last one and meeting all three party leaders, and they were all very sort of civil and said, you know, well, if I lose, I'll accept the result. And sure enough, the president lost and handed over power.
Yes. The last ones, there was a little bit of a kerfuffle and some delays. And there's a whole problem because they don't have a register of voters. And this is something that has to be addressed. But when you visit Somaliland, what you get is a sense of a country it's sort of setting the building blocks in place. And then there are all obvious things that are missing, like there aren't any banks there. There isn't a register of voters. But there's this sort of baby state that has been working on setting up all these building blocks for 22 years. And it's saying, please reward us by recognizing us, because if you don't recognize us, we can't get international funding from, you know, that we need to build our infrastructure. And there are all sorts of things that happen if you don't have international recognition.
And so, for example, you know, there isn't any international aid really going in. We the West are spending an awful lot of money propping up a slightly dubious government in Mogadishu.
Well, it's not quite the case, because what happens is that we have DFID, for example, you know, our development ministry sends money to Somalia, but actually a lot of that goes to Somaliland. They've just very proudly announced the launch of Somaliland Development Fund with the Danes, and that's the sort of, like, it's as close as you can get to direct budgetary support as you can go without recognizing a government. So it wouldn't be true to say that all the money's been going to the south. I mean, Somaliland, because it is peaceful, because it is a place that is setting up basic structures, does actually have quite a lot of donor input. But I think there's all sorts of issues of insurance, of trust, of investment, you know, the way institutions and investors look at your country if you're not recognized as a state.
You mentioned before that there are no banks. So one of the ways that money is transferred from, particularly from the diaspora, back to Somaliland is through remittances, through Dahab Shahil and other agencies as well. And they've got a problem with this now, haven't they? Because Barclays is pulling the plug.
Well, because of money laundering regulations in the States and massive fines that have been levied against banks that were found to be, you know, not rigorous enough, the Barclays has said, look, we just want to close down the accounts of the money transfer companies here in the West. And that essentially means that they wouldn't be able to operate out in Somaliland. And that presents everyone with a huge problem. When the civil war broke out, a lot of Somalilanders left. They went to Sweden, they went to Canada, they came here to the UK, and they send money back. And they make it possible for millions of Somalilanders to survive. So how are they going to transfer their money back? There's a whole campaign now being waged to say to Barclays, you know, he's saying, for goodness sake, you're going to cripple this country. And when I was there, I spoke to the Minister of Planning, who used to work, he used to be the London manager of one of the biggest companies, transfer companies. And he was saying, well, you know, the whole economy depends on this. We have $400 million worth of remittances that come through money transfer every year. But also what he said in the end, he was quite sanguine because he was saying, well, we'll find a way. And I think his warning is that if you don't let this go through the established existing money transfer companies, it'll just happen on the sly. And in the end, that's what tends to support terrorism. It's people, you know, who get onto flights with huge sort of briefcases full of money.
And that was Michaela Wrong there speaking to our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield.
In the next half hour of the programme, we'll be in Nairobi for a check of what's making the headlines. We'll review this morning's Turkish front pages and we hear the story of a rap duo from Dundee who made it big by taking on fake accents and pretending to be from California.
So we used one talent to highlight another talent. That's marketing. That's not lying, really. Once we were in and everyone saw that the talent was real, it was just like, oh, wow.
But first, here is Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. US defense officials say the nuclear-powered aircraft carrier, the USS Nimitz, and other ships in its strike group are heading west towards the Red Sea to help support a limited US strike on Syria if needed. On Sunday, members of the US Congress met President Obama's national security team to discuss the possibility of military action. The Egyptian state prosecutor says the ousted president, Mohamed Morsi, is to be tried for inciting the murder of protesters. 14 members of Morsi's Muslim Brotherhood will also stand trial on the same charges. North and South Korean delegations come together today for the first meeting of the newly formed Joint Committee on Kaesong Industrial Complex. Kaesong, situated in the north, was closed down in April amidst high tension on the Korean Peninsula, with Pyongyang threatening the United States and the South with missile attacks. The wildfire, which has destroyed around 6% of Yosemite National Park, is now the fourth largest in California's history. The California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection says five of the state's seven largest fires in recorded history have occurred since 2007. A 24-year-old Welshman has become the most expensive footballer ever. Cardiff-born Gareth Bale has finally completed his long-awaited move from the English club Tottenham Hotspur to the Spanish giants Real Madrid for a fee of €100 million. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
You are back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Marco Sippi and Phil Hahn. The Great Hip Hop Hoax is a new film that tells the fascinating story of a rap duo from Dundee who tried and failed to make it big. But instead of giving up, they became a syllable and brains. A hip hop duo from California, fake American accents and all. They ended up becoming stars with record deals, sellout shows and A&Rs at various labels, duking it out to represent them.
The accents never slipped, but their grip on reality loosened to the point of madness. It's a moving and charming cautionary tale on achieving your dreams, but in a funny fashion. The film is released to the public this week, and to get more on the full story, we invited Brian McLeod himself, otherwise known as Gavin Bain, into the studio to talk to Robert Bound for this week's Culture Show.
It was like having two early M&Ms, and they're from America. That means they're amazing.
They were very young, they were dynamic. My plan was to use the Sony system to take them to the world. But
I
don't care, I'm a mess. I'm like a
plastic surgeon, I'm always staring at breasts. I mean, I thought for Beastie Boys. I grew my pubes to my nipples to
put some hair on my chest. I'm just a... Basically, we were really good at acting.
So we used one talent to highlight another talent. That's marketing. That's not lying, really. You know, that's how we looked at it. I mean, if we became actors, our job would be faking it every day on set. So we basically just acted. And in doing that, once we were in and everyone saw that the talent was real and the skills was real, it was just like, oh, wow. I call that marketing. No, people would literally not listen to us if we were as we were, but we simply painted ourselves purple or luminous, you know, yeah. American.
And that was it.
Chris Rock's got a great line in it. I think it's his line in the documentary where if hip-hop's about authenticity and credibility, then you at least were genuine fakes.
Which yeah, is that's a great line yeah, as a genuinely fake. But, yeah, but I mean, if you really look at hip-hop, you know, what it also kind of highlights is really, is anyone this idea of real, this keep it real thing is kind of nonsense. I mean, you look at like rap videos and they've got the mansion hired, all the girls dancing around, they don't know them, cars hired, you know. So at the end of a video shoot where they put across this notion of they are gangster or they are real, and then they put it away and they go back to their home and they kiss their mum good night, and it's nothing's real. It's that whole keep it real idea was created to sell records.
Now I know that you're still obviously making music. Does a film like this and does your sort of past career as Silver in Brains, does it help or hinder what you're doing now? Do you feel wiser about the industry, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, in a big way, I almost feel like I can work with the industry now, you know, because I kind of feel like I'm inside the joke now, you know? Like, when you're an artist coming through, you're just the silly artist. You don't know what you're talking about. But now, a lot of labels and people come and ask me what I think the curve is. So I'm telling a lot of people how to do their jobs now. So I'm pretty much kind of in the circle now. So it's helped, but it's also made me realize that if they're asking me how to do things, I don't really need them, you know? So it's empowering as well. But I don't look back and go, oh, that's held us back in any way. I think every single thing that happened for a crazy reason, because we are literally in the best situation ever now. You know, we'd never been in this. Any normal artist, how long does their career last? Maybe, what, 2-3 years if they're lucky? And also the big thing is when you're a musician coming through, you have someone style you, you have someone think about your image, you have someone write your songs for you, you have someone doing everything, telling you your dance routines. Syllable and Brains did everything ourselves. We never let the labels have one bit of control over us. And that is unheard of. That is pretty legendary.
We're talking now in the end of August 2013. When was the last time you spoke in that cod Californian accent?
I had to do it yesterday because Chris Rock asked me. He was like, come on, man, put on your voice. And I was like, yo, Chris, like, what's going on, man? Like, I hate this voice now. I can't do this anymore, you know?
This is the thing, right? I was going to ask you, but I didn't have to.
The unmistakable Californian accent there from Gavin Bain. Marcus, could you pull off a Californian accent, American accent?
I'm really bad at that, you know. I have a Finnish accent and a less Finnish accent, and then I have my very bad American accent.
Let's hear the less Finnish accent.
No, I have to do that after the show. Okay. You're listening to Midori House with me, Marco Sippi and Phil Han. We're back right after this with a check-in with our man in Nairobi.
The Golden Leopard is the Locarno Film Festival's top prize, but it's not just the leopard print branding that sets this film festival apart. Since 1946, film lovers have been drawn to the unique mix of art and commerce at play in this Swiss mountain setting.
This is part of the spirit of Locarno, that directors talk about their craft rather than hearing a rooftop shouted mega deals. Is this emphasis on new, international art house a deliberate plan to weed out the hoi polloi and set Locarno apart? No. Locarno wants to be all about honouring cinema's rich history, discovering new talent, and doing business.
Robert Bound's report on the Locarno Film Festival is now showing in the films menu on monocle.com.
Monocle 24 is your 24-hour-a-day international radio service. Based in the heart of London, with contributions from our bureau in Hong Kong, Tokyo, New York, Toronto and Zurich, and reporters in more than 30 countries, we broadcast a mix of news, discussion, features, reportage, reviews, music and more. From retail to travel, food to urbanism, business to film, Monocle 24 has it covered.
One of the things that I would like to allude to, which is very much the kind of thing that you're doing here, is you're having this kind of discussion. But the discussion that needs to take place, where the forward thinking needs to come from, is from the brains trusts and the think tanks, and they're not doing it.
To call it an international conference, that's difficult in itself. The really difficult thing is then to start to implement the conclusions.
I was actually the last correspondent to send dispatches by carrier pigeon. It's not something I'm proud of.
There are two kinds of games. The games that uses the city, and the other kinds the city that uses the games.
Plus, our carefully curated playlist is the soundtrack to your day, stretching from Stockholm to Sydney, Brooklyn to Bogota.
It was like entering the gates of heaven.
You can hear us live at monocle.com, catch up with anything you may have missed on our Time Shift player, download our bespoke app for your smartphone, and hear it all on iTunes.
I like the sense that you just have no idea where it's going to go.
Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You are listening to Midori House. The time is 16:39 in Tokyo, 8:39 here in London. It's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world.
Joining us on the line from Nairobi is Tristan McConnell, where the time in Nairobi is 10:39. Welcome to the show, Tristan. Let's begin with Eastern Congo. Of course, just a couple of days, M23 rebels announced that they would be withdrawing. So it looks like some good news there on that front.
Yeah, you might think that. So the M23 rebel group announced a sort of a unilateral ceasefire and withdrew from some positions. But in reality, that hasn't actually stopped the fighting. There was more fighting on Saturday. And basically what it seems is that the Congolese army kind of smells blood here and has continued its advance, albeit without the support in this particular case of this new United Nations so-called intervention brigade, which seems to have proved quite helpful during the fighting last week. So unfortunately for, you know, the people in Eastern Congo, this withdrawal by the M23 and its announcement ceasefire hasn't brought peace, at least not yet.
Where do you see this all going to? Are M23 rebels indeed withdrawing then?
Right, yeah, that's a tricky question to answer. I mean, this kind of conflict in Eastern Congo, the M23 rebellion is really just the latest iteration of a whole host of conflicts that are interlinked and go back, you know, nearly 20 years now. So whether even the defeat of the M23 is going to bring real lasting peace to Eastern Congo, I think that's kind of doubtful. In terms of the fight against the M23, I think a lot will depend on Rwanda. United Nations investigators and human rights investigators and others have accused Rwanda of supporting the M23 rebels. Rwanda denies these allegations, but you know, if Rwanda was to openly involve itself in this conflict in Eastern Congo, and that does seem, you know, a possibility, because they've said that these occasional mortars and shells which have sort of flown across the border into Rwanda is something that they will not allow to stand, and they will, you know, they say it's within their rights to retaliate. I think if we see Rwanda's involvement, then things could escalate very badly. If Rwanda stays out and the Congolese army continues its offensive with UN support against the M23, then we could see the M23 degraded very heavily, to the extent that they no longer really pose a threat to many people, and certainly to the town of Goma in Eastern Congo.
And of course, Rwanda has twice before invaded Congo during the 1990s. An interesting comment made by the foreign minister of Rwanda on Friday: Rwandan troops are not in the Democratic Republic of Congo yet. When they are, you will know. Is it likely, in your estimation, that this conflict could potentially escalate?
I think that's a very real concern. I mean, that you quoted there the foreign minister, and it was quite bizarre, her sort of issuing things that could very easily be interpreted as threats via her Twitter feed. But as you say, Rwanda has been involved in the past. They see this as, you know, Eastern Congo to Rwanda is a very sort of important strategic part of the country, and it borders Rwanda. It's where instability frequently comes from, and they see securing Eastern Congo, or rather having a secure Eastern Congo, as absolutely integral to their own domestic security. And they say, you know, the argument from the Rwandans is the Congolese government is dysfunctional, it's incapable of maintaining security in the east, and if they won't do it, then we will. And that's the argument that Rwanda put forward, and you can see where they're coming from. on with that. Now, if Rwanda does decide to get openly involved again, then I think things will escalate very badly. Don't forget that this new UN intervention brigade consists of troops from South Africa, from Malawi, from Tanzania. So we're talking about regional armies involved, where normally, you know, the peacekeepers are usually made up of, say, Indians or Pakistanis. So we could see a regional conflagration emerge pretty fast if Rwanda gets openly involved.
Tristan, let's continue with a new story from South Africa, something we actually mentioned already earlier in this program today. South Africa's first democratically elected president, Nelson Mandela, returned home from hospital on Sunday. How extensively has this been reported in Nairobi?
Yeah, look, every twist and turn of Nelson Mandela's ill health and hospitalization is reported here in Nairobi and you know, elsewhere in Africa, from what I've seen, as much as it is in the West, in the Europe, in the US. You know, Nelson Mandela is a revered figure across the African continent, just as he is across the world. And people are just as worried about, you know, his health conditions as they are elsewhere. And so this latest discharge is being followed, you know, as much here in Nairobi as anywhere else.
And Tristan, earlier we heard from Martin Plaut, and he said that, you know, many people within Mandela's family are in a sense jockeying for position to take over kind of that position of power within the family and the country. Do you think that's a fair estimate from your perspective?
I certainly think that's an accurate kind of reflection from what I can tell of the sort of family dynamics. But to me, the important point about these sort of really rather unseemly family disputes that have emerged in recent weeks that involve, you know, exhuming bodies and reburying them and court fights, all of this sort of horrible stuff that's sort of been dragged out into the bright media light, what that's done is really just served to underline quite how unique and incredible a person Nelson Mandela is. I mean, you know, he is a very special individual who did some quite incredible things. And these sort of family disputes, which is the kind of behavior you would see in, you know, any other family, albeit more publicly revealed this time, just show once again that he's, you know, he is a very unique individual. There's nothing special about, like, his family background or where he's coming from. It's all about him. And that, again, underscores why we are so fascinated and so interested in really every twist and turn of his health problems at the moment.
And then, Tristan, one more story from Somalia. A TEDx talk was held in Mogadishu on Saturday. Do you know what the discussion topics were?
Yeah, I mean, they had a range of discussions. There were about 14 speakers. It might not be your classic TEDx sort of agenda in terms of, you know, design and technology and so forth. But I think the most important thing about this TEDx the conference they held is that it happened at all. This is the second year in a row that they've done it. In terms of the speakers, we had human rights activists, we had small businessmen, a guy who opened the first dry cleaners in Mogadishu, which was seen as a symbol of returning normality. We had a chef speaking. We had a young Canadian Somali woman who's a commander in the army. So really it was more of a kind of social discussion, if you like. But I think the very fact that they were able to pull this off and live streamed it around the world for anyone who wants to watch just shows that, you know, in certain parts of Somalia, it's possible to see some kind of a normality taking root.
Good news there. That was Tristan McConnell in Nairobi. Good talking to you. Thank you.
And in just a few moments, we'll be having a flick through this morning's Turkish front pages with Alex de Kramer. But before we do, we have time for a bit of music. Here is Murat Dalkılıç with Bir Hali.
Kendime iyi baktım bir hayli.
The lovely sounds there of Murat Dakulic with Bir Hayli.
You are listening to Midori House with me, Markus Hippi and Phil Hahn. It's time now for us to have a look through this morning's front pages, and today we are turning our attention to Turkey. Monocle's Alex de Kramer joins us in the studio now, armed with a hefty pile of papers. Good morning, Alex.
Good morning.
What shall we start with?
So I want to start with Sözcü, the spokesman, that their biggest headline today is a quote from Prime Minister Erdogan, who, contrary to the US and France, does not want to have a parliament meeting to discuss Syria and over the weekend. We just had our foreign minister say that they have confirmed that their chemical weapons, the Turkish intelligence has confirmed that there have been chemical weapons used in Syria. But other than Davutoğlu, no one is on the side to bring the parliament members together and discuss it and reach to a conclusion together. Basically, he said that our President Gül knows what he's doing, and I will discuss the rest of this.
And I guess it's been quite clear Turkey's position on the crisis in Syria. Of course, Turkey is one of the most adamant opponents of Bashar al-Assad and his regime. Mm-hmm. They've been really pressuring other international leaders to act in Syria. They've been pressuring the U.S. to militarily intervene. So I guess it's not really a question of kind of a debate about what position the government
will
hold. Of
course, yeah, that's true. But there's still, to some extent, like, there has been a breakdown in our army, and we are not that strong in terms of weaponry and army infrastructure just as a team. So, first of all, our air force has, in the past 5 years, has diminished, their power has diminished increasingly. And, of course, with NATO putting 4 Patriot missiles on the border in Hatay and Adana and these regions close to the Syrian border, has stated that Turkey is obviously against the Syrian Bashar al-Assad regimes in Syria, and they have taken measures for that. But it's still not enough. We're not prepared enough to be part of an intervention, or to some extent used as a base, because we share such a huge border with them. And it would mean that we would jeopardize a region which is already under jeopardy due to the PKK, and because everything is just happening. It's kind of a really bad timing in terms of, like, Erdogan initiated a Kurdish peace talks 2 years ago, a year ago, not even. That's happening. We're still gaining our interactions with the people in that region. Elections are coming up in March, and they have to kind of convince people to go to war. Because every citizen, every Turkish citizen, Turkish citizen in Turkey needs to go to the army, and that's how already has been a debated topic for ages and ages, because that's not existent in many countries anymore.
Alex, how do people feel about that on the street level?
About
the situation in Syria and what to do with it.
That's one of the problem that. Obviously, it's affecting us a lot. For example, just this weekend, there were 15,000 Syrian refugees coming into the country. It's huge. And they have made their way through to Istanbul and Izmir. There are around 2,000 people sleeping in the parks at the moment in Izmir. And they can't get them out because they don't have enough money to go anywhere. We don't have the infrastructure to put up tents, and we don't have a place to put them. They're building refugee camps but with the help of EU. There are a couple of shelters that are built, but everything is still under process.
But I guess refugees are one issue and military intervention is another. Of course, we've seen here in the UK, public support for military intervention in Syria is quite low. The exact same situation in the United States. Do people in Turkey want to see an intervention?
Probably not.
No. Okay. Well, let's move on to another story in the Milliyet newspaper. It's Victory Day celebrations.
Yeah,
happy Victory Day.
Thank you. So this marks the end of the biggest battle won in World War One on Turkish territories. And so for the past 2 years, we didn't have an event, a reception, Victory Day reception, because our President Abdullah Gül was sick. And before that, it was held by the Turkish armed forces. The chief commander of the armed forces hosts a dinner and invites a lot of people. And because President Gül's wife, Hayri, has been covered, she hasn't been invited for this for 6 years now that he has been in power. And with the Agenon Cohen case, this has kind of turned hands. And Abdullah Gül has been wanted to host it for the past 2 years. And this is the first time, actually, it's been held in the presidential palace, which is interesting. It was a big deal. It was in the garden, and there were two TRT speakers come and talk about, and there were speeches held. That was a fun event for us.
How important is this for people? For example, what does the Victory Day mean for
you? It's really important. It's like one of the third biggest celebrations we have. It's national holiday. First, it starts with everyone goes to the Muslim of Atatürk. People walk on the street. When I was in high school, I was part of the team that walked because there's like a national parade. So every student, there's like a group each year that has to go and participate in these events, like a band thing.
How'd you celebrate it this year?
I didn't do anything. Oh.
Should be ashamed. And finally, Alex, let's move on to a final story, which you have from the Hurriyet, and it's all about peace steps.
Yeah, so this is a kind of lighter thing. In Beyoğlu municipality has painted over 200 steps that were painted as rainbow colors. This was like a fun project done by a forest engineer. So he painted these steps in the rainbow colors. And they just painted over gray. And I think I just chose the story because it's interesting to show like how people overly react to government intervention in their property. Because since the Beyoğlu municipality painted these rainbow stairs into gray, everyone started protesting about it. Now, this is the biggest thing. Like, everyone's just on the streets. Diyarbakır made their own rainbow stairs and they're sitting and posing. So this entire weekend, all the weekend editions of newspapers, Hürriyet included, had pictures of cities around Turkey showing these steps that people painted in to support that Beyoğlu municipality should paint these steps back, because they're peace steps. Which is interesting. And today is Peace Day, actually. And Gezi Park is closed because of Ahmed protests. Yeah.
That was Monocle's Alex de Kramer here in the studio for us.
Happy Peace Day, everyone. Well, that unfortunately is all the time we have for today. Thanks to our producer, Danny Giacopelli, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Chris Fitch. Up next after the news is The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck, and I'll be back with Marcus for Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But from me, Phil Hahn.
And me, Marcus Hippip. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.